At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Could it finally be farewell for Fannie and Freddie? Getting the government out of the mortgage business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, August 6th. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. If you've got a mortgage, there's a pretty good chance that Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac is involved. These two giant companies own or guarantee more than half the mortgages in the U.S. Their fate has been up in the air ever since they cratered in 2008, sticking taxpayers with a $187 billion tab. Today, President Obama proposed winding them down, getting the government out of the home loan business. That would involve completely rethinking where the money for your house comes from. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has the story.
The strange and scary world without Fannie and Freddie is actually already here. They can't guarantee loans over $417,000 in most places. Folks at the speech can see that world inside the Arizona mortgage brokerage where Teresa Murrieta works. Just ask about jumbo loans.
The interest rate is higher. Typically, you have to put a little bit more down. The guidelines for your income, assets, and credit are a little bit stricter.
Without Fannie and Freddie, the whole mortgage market could end up looking more like the jumbo market. It'll be even tougher for home buyers than it is now, which freaks people out. But Arizona State real estate professor Andra Gent says homeownership will go on.
I don't think it's the sort of doomsday scenario people imagine it to be. Other countries don't have Fannie and Freddie.
Yes, people outside America buy homes too. Trulia chief economist Jed Kolko explains how.
Borrowers in other countries typically see shorter mortgages, mortgages that adjust as interest rates adjust. In other words, mortgages that shift more of the risk onto consumers.
The 30-year fixed loan is the standard in America, but uncommon elsewhere. Here, the hypothetical ends. President Obama is pledging to protect access to the 30-year fixed. Private banks won't take that risk alone, so there has to be some role for government in backstopping home loans. Remove Fannie and Freddie, and something else takes their place. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Obamacare sign-up has begun. Well, kinda. People who want to buy insurance on the new exchanges can now register for an account at healthcare.gov. They can actually start using the accounts on October 1st. And to help guide you through the process, the government is training an army of so-called navigators. Well, it turns out the navigators need a little help, too. Stan Alcorn reports.
Deductibles, coinsurance, in-network, out-of-network. Health insurance is complicated, especially for people who've never had it. The plans being offered on insurance exchanges this October are supposed to simplify things, but
the problem is that they're giving you simplified information about things that are inherently complicated.
George Lowenstein is an economist whose research shows people don't understand how insurance works, much less how it works on the new exchanges. That's where the navigators come in. They're trained to do outreach and walk people through the process. Jennifer Tolbert is the director of state health reform at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
I think these Navigator programs are really critical to getting people enrolled into coverage.
But 2 months out, training for navigators in states with federally run exchanges hasn't even begun. That's putting some states in a bind.
States like Texas, Florida, Georgia, where you've got a limited amount of money and you have very large numbers of uninsured.
Linda Sutherland is the executive director of the Healthy Start Coalition, which plans to hire 5 navigators in Orange County, Florida.
We're one of the highest rates of uninsured in the country. And so I think a lot of those people are used to just accessing the emergency room for care.
Sutherland says they'll have a lot to learn about insurance once the exchanges open on October 1st. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Warren Buffett, Rupert Murdoch, and now Jeff Bezos. Billionaires love to buy newspapers, like their predecessor William Randolph Hearst, who inspired Citizen Kane. But what are they getting for that money? If it's influence, can owning a paper get you anywhere near the kind of clout it used to? Sally Herships reports.
Moguls, titans, press lords, all names for the rich and powerful owners of newspapers. Take the movie Citizen Kane. In this scene, Charles Kane, the paper's wealthy owner, gets a cable from a reporter in Cuba.
Girls, delightful in Cuba, stop.
Could send you prose poems about scenery, but don't feel right spending your money. Stop. There is no war in Cuba. Signed, Wheeler. Any answer?
Yes, dear Wheeler, you provide the prose poems. I'll provide the war.
But that's the movies. Does owning a newspaper today really mean you can control the news? Wharton professor Daniel Rath.
If you watch Citizen Kane and think, gosh, could anybody have done this sort of thing? Colonel McCormick is your first port of call.
Rath says before World War II, the owner of the Chicago Tribune, Robert McCormick, was known for preaching isolationism through his paper. And more recently, says Rath, Rupert Murdoch blurred the line between private and public interests. So what about Jeff Bezos?
The question is, what's in it for me?
Robert Lichter is director of George Mason University's Center for Media and Public Affairs. He says newspapers have changed. They're no longer a stable source of revenue. Instead...
Well, you get social prominence. You get social stature. It's like buying a sports team, but more serious.
But Lichter says it may not be the news at all Jeff Bezos is after with the Washington Post. Instead, it may be readers' valuable data. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, red across the board. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the stock market booming, there's no shortage of companies looking to cash in. They're selling their stock to investors for the first time in IPOs, initial public offerings. 116 IPOs so far this year. That's up about a third from this time last year. 12 this week alone. So what's going on? Josh Brown is Vice President of Investments at Fusion Analytics. Josh, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
What's up with the IPO market? Why is it doing so well this year?
Well, I think there's a demand aspect to it, because if you look at the two areas where we're seeing the most deals, one plays into the whole search for yield, and then the other are social media deals. So Twitter and Dropbox are now in the queue, lined up to go public, and people are now looking at Facebook. It's back above its IPO price, so they're looking for the next deal. So I think between those two aspects, that's why you're seeing so many companies come and get a favorable reaction.
So you said the F word, Facebook. It IPO'd, the price went down, it's come back up. Has that given people confidence?
So IPO for about a year and a couple of months was a dirty word in Silicon Valley. People looked at the reception that Zuckerberg got and they said, that's not for me. But the mindset is changing. And as a result, you're seeing more companies waiting in the wings and not ashamed of it.
A lot of people hear the word IPO and, you know, maybe they think of the 90s when you had this first wave of tech companies. How is this different?
First of all, it's not all technology companies. And second of all, there are companies coming public that are older you know, more established names. We went through this period, Lizzie, where IPOs became a dirty word because so many of them were private equity exits. So, for example, a hotel chain that a private equity firm owned, it was off the market. This was their chance to get liquid, sell it, and take in the cash. That was what went on for a lot of the last few years, but that's changing. Now you're seeing companies come and tap the market that are doing so for the right reason, which is to grow, which is to take advantage of the fact that the markets are improving, raise some money, open new stores, hire people. It's a very positive sign.
So no bubble then?
No. I mean, you have to have lived through prior IPO bubbles to know just how tame this one is. When you start seeing the window gaping wide open and a new IPO every day, maybe we can have that discussion, but we're not quite there yet. I would say this is extraordinarily healthy activity for the early stages of an economic recovery.
Josh Brown, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bigger has always been better for Americans who want to show a little affluence on the road. For years, they chose to drive roomy luxury sedans, maybe an SUV with leather detailing. But the recession left a legacy on our spending habits that's showing up on car lots and across income brackets. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Noelle King has the story.
Let's say for a minute that we're not talking about cars. We're talking about the American dream. Because isn't that what car companies are trying to sell us? So, meet one guy with an American dream.
Hi, my name is Edgar.
Edgar Perez, a salesman at Bunnin Chevrolet in Los Angeles, is taking me for a test drive in a 2013 Chevy Spark.
So let's go ahead and give it a spin.
All right, let's give it a spin. Edgar came to the United States from Mexico when he was a year old.
I'm 19 years old.
So did you get this job right out of high school?
Yeah, absolutely, I did.
What kind of car do you drive?
I drive a Cruze.
A Chevy Cruze. It's a small car, good gas mileage, inexpensive, exactly the kind of car you'd expect a young guy like Edgar to drive. Edgar attends Santa Monica College, and he plans to get his MBA, like a customer he met recently.
This guy graduated from Costa Long Beach, got his MBA.
And he's rich.
He was winning more than $55,000 a month.
Edgar was impressed.
His house was in Beverly Hills. Could you imagine being the number one top in the hill?
So, once Edgar gets his MBA and gets closer to that American dream?
Once I get an MBA, I would say I would still want a compact vehicle. In the future, I'll probably get the same Cruze, just in a newer model. So, a newer year, in other words.
This is the kind of statement that sends the auto industry into a frenzy. A young man who expects to make good money saying he plans on sticking with a compact car. Car manufacturers are facing a crisis. High gas prices, a shrinking middle class, young people saddled with more college debt than ever before. So the auto industry has to listen to people like Edgar.
Just about every mainstream manufacturer is offering an A or B segment vehicle.
That's industry speak for smaller cars. Andy Lilienthal is a subcompact geek. He started a website in 2007 devoted to small cars. It was a hobby. When the recession hit, he noticed something.
I kept thinking, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, we're getting all these world-class small cars, which is pretty amazing considering back in the 90s, early 2000s, subcompact cars pretty much almost disappeared from the landscape.
But there's a challenge. Cars are supposed to be aspirational, part of the American dream, remember? So the last thing people want is a car that reminds them of their diminished circumstances.
And you can tell from the names there's been a big effort to convey that these are fun vehicles.
Justin Berkowitz of Car and Driver says since 2006, the number of subcompact and mini car brands has doubled.
We hear Fiesta, Party, and Versa being a typical Nissan fake word implying versatile. All of these get at the same idea, which is that they're practical but fun. Please don't think of this car as a punishment or as a constant reminder of your economic status.
Berkowitz says there's an upside. The growing influence of small cars means they're getting better features, infotainment systems, GPS, iPod interfaces.
So at least if we're going towards a lowest common denominator, it will be a very good low common denominator. We will end up with safe, reasonable cars. You can call it a silver lining. We don't have reason to despair just yet.
And as for the 1%, they're apparently jumping on the small car bandwagon. Berkowitz says luxury brands like BMW are, for the first time, offering smaller models for sale in the U.S. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
We've got a fun visualization of what kinds of cars people at different incomes buy, and a few more things we know about you based on your income at Marketplace.org.
Coming up,
it's a herbivore and a carnivore, and they obviously weren't friends. They were found together, and we're assuming that they killed each other.
Bet those will fetch a nice price. A look at the dino bones market. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street stumbled again today on more talk that the Fed might start tapering its bond buying as soon as September. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 93 points, or 0.6%, to land at 15,518. The NASDAQ dropped 27 points, that's 0.75%, ending at 3665. The S&P gave up 9 points, 0.6%, closing at 1697. The Washington Post wrote up 4% on news that Jeff Bezos is buying the paper. His other company, Amazon, shaved off 0.1%. Investors withdrew 1% from Bank of America today after the Justice Department sued over alleged fraud in the sale of mortgage-backed securities worth $850 million. Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and Citigroup all let go 2%. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. On August 7th, 1789, President Washington established the War Department. It is now the Department of Defense. Also tomorrow, the Federal Reserve releases consumer credit data for June. And in New Orleans, the National Barbie Doll Collectors Convention gets underway. Events include designing shoes for Barbie's wardrobe, changeable hairstyles for her, and taking Barbie shopping. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Some of you may have fond memories of summer school. I'm sorry, did I say fond? I meant miserable. Stuck in class while everyone else was at the pool or singing camp songs or whatever. These days, thanks to the internet and shrinking school budgets, this particular brand of torture has a new name, online summer school. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports. Get used to hearing about it.
Welcome to the future of summer school.
Nutrition during the teen years.
Online style.
Please click the next button to continue.
For about a month this summer, this is how 14-year-old Sabrina Sampson studied ninth grade health.
So I'm going to be doing orchestra this year. So I wanted to free up room in my schedule.
Lessons and assignments were all done online. The class, run by a private company, costs $500.
Each lesson would be a sort of interactive PowerPoint presentation with audio and videos. They're more like YouTube videos than lecture videos.
There is a tremendous growth in the amount of online courses students are taking.
And it's not because of the whole YouTube factor, says Patty Bart. She directs the Center for Public Education.
School districts are cutting back on summer school programs as a way to balance their budget shortfalls.
In Los Angeles, for example, last year there was $40 million in the budget for summer school. This year, there's $1 million. Districts in Philadelphia and Florida have also cut their summer programs.
Traditional summer school program is very expensive because a lot of it's overtime. The online program is about 50% the cost.
Joseph Gagnon is CEO of Penn Foster. Its web-based courses in subjects like earth science and world literature pull in thousands of high school students a year. He says without an instructor standing over the class, Penn Foster keeps students engaged by relying on what usually distracts them.
Use text messaging and email. Use chat or Facebook, use a social community.
But students also need to be good at time management and self-directed learning. Bart with the Center for Public Education says there isn't much data on how many kids make it to the finish line, but it can be easy to slip through the digital cracks.
Many students are getting lost in cyberspace, and we're not getting the results out of the online courses.
And for students who think it's going to be a breeze, not so, says Sabrina Sampson, who, by the way, got an A+ in her health class.
You kind of think, oh, health class, that should be easy, but it was actually really intense for what I thought it would be.
Turns out, even online, it's still summer school, and no amount of technology can change that. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
What if you could get cash out of the bank with your handprint? It's happening in Brazil. Alex Schmidt has this story about the explosion of biometrics and what it could mean for the future.
There are about a dozen ATMs in a glass-walled room on the sprawling Sao Paulo corporate campus of Bradesco, one of Brazil's largest banks. In 2006, Bradesco became the first bank in Brazil to start using biometric ID at its ATMs. Hand vein readers. Nelson Lemos, a manager in the bank's IT department, demonstrates.
We have a new system here, okay, with contactless.
Okay.
It's not necessary to put in the card.
You touch your card to the console, place your hand on the scanner, and...
That's good.
That's all.
Yes.
It's so fast.
There's also the option of getting cash without a card. You just use your hand and enter a couple of codes. The system is incredibly convenient. It's also extra secure, says Lemos.
Since the biometric systems, the fraud declined, older ATMs don't show the same improvement since they don't have that systems. So it did help Bradesco to avoid fraud.
Banks in Brazil added biometric ID to deal with challenges the U.S. doesn't face. For example, government IDs in Brazil can be easily forged, so lots of people have opened fraudulent bank accounts. And there's a problem of illiteracy. When folks go to collect their monthly welfare payments, banks see huge lines of people waiting to get reminded of their PIN. Jonathan Moyer is a director at the Center of International Futures at the University of Denver. He says it makes sense to see large-scale biometric systems in rapidly developing countries like Brazil and India, which has a huge government-sponsored biometric ID program.
It's these countries that are in this kind of development sweet spot, where you have the demand for this, and you have the overall resources to be able to put something like this in place. You have to have this interesting confluence of development, yet underdeveloped problems.
Implementing a large-scale biometric system is expensive, as much as $50 million for Brazilian banks to retrofit their ATMs. And that doesn't include the cost of getting people into the database. The project made sense for the banks because it saved them money, possibly as much as one real or 50 cents per person. Because banks have led the way, the technology is spreading, says Fabricio Vargas. He's head of business development at Biomatica, a Brazilian firm specializing in biometrics.
For example, if you go to your market and you forget your wallet, it might be you'll be able to buy with your mobile and your fingerprint, for example. There are some great retail chains here in Brazil starting to try here and there.
Hey, I want to go to a store and use my finger and phone to buy stuff. But we don't have a large-scale rollout of biometrics in the U.S. yet. So where could we see the technology really start to touch consumers? Here's a clue. Earlier this year, Apple took out a patent on fingerprint sensors. I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
So when I was a kid, I wanted to be a paleontologist. I wanted to grow up and hunt for dinosaur bones. So I'm kind of jealous of Clayton Phipps, because that's what he does. And it's not a hobby. He makes a living by selling ancient bones to the highest bidder. Now, a massive pair of skeletons he found in Montana is going to come up for auction with a target price of over $7 million. Clayton Phipps is not a scientist. He calls himself the Dino Cowboy. Clayton, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So
Tell me a little bit about this particular fossil find.
Oh, man. You know, we were blessed with this find. It's a herbivore and a carnivore, and they obviously weren't friends. They were found together, and we're assuming that they killed each other and got buried together very quickly. They're both virtually 100% complete. They're a Christmas present waiting to be unwrapped. There's a lot of science to be gleaned from this discovery.
Tell me about something you found in the past and how much it went for.
Well, you know, when I first started doing this, it was more of a hobby. It was right after the movie Jurassic Park came out, so there was a big dinosaur craze. And, well, heck, that's cool. I'll start looking around, you know, see if I can find anything. And, oh, I suppose it was probably about 4 years into it, I took 2 weeks off and went fossil hunting, and I found a little dragon skull. And I sold it, and I got about a year's wages for my part. You know, the landowner got his share, and the guy that prepared it got his share.
What's that work out to for you?
Let's see. I think I ended up with about 40-some thousand. And I told my wife, I said, I think I want to quit my job and see if we can do this. And about that time, our family ranch split up, and I ended up with a little chunk just not quite big enough to starve to death on. So I decided, you know, I'm going to try to see if we can supplement our income with fossils.
If this is going to come up for an auction, the projected price is somewhere between $7 and $9 million. Why auction it? Why not give it to a museum and let little kids come see it for just the sake of learning?
Well, you know, I'm obviously trying to feed my family doing this, so, you know, I've got a lot invested into this project, and it's an investment I made. And my goal when I started doing this was to let landowners know that there's some value in their fossils. I've watched people come to our county and take the fossils and not even tell anybody where they came from or give no credit to our area or anything. And to me, it seemed like the landowners ought to realize something out of what's being taken off their place.
Say this thing sells and you get a cut. Is that it? You going to hang up your fossil hunting spurs?
Nah, I enjoy it too much. No, it's too fun.
Is there another one out there that you're looking for now?
It's like gold, man. It's where you find it. Yeah, I'm sure there's more out there in the hills. Good Lord willing, I'll find another one someday.
Clayton Phipps, thank you so much for talking with me.
Hey, you're welcome.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today. We know Jeff Bezos is spending $250 million to buy the Washington Post, which made us a little curious about other ways he's spending money. That includes a 200-foot clock that's being built inside a mountain on his property in West Texas. It's supposed to be able to run for thousands of years, with special chimes each decade, century, millennium. You get the picture. Bezos calls it the 10,000-year clock. Thus far, according to the Wall Street Journal, he spent $42 million on it, about one-sixth of the cost of the Washington Post. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 93 points, or 0.6%. The NASDAQ dropped 27 points, that's 0.75%. And the S&P 500 gave up 9 points, 0.6%. Thanks to Justin Ho, Caitlin Esch, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The interim producer of the Marketplace Morning Report is Sean Bowditch. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.